It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, what does Republican control of the Senate mean for the remainder of U.S. President Barack Obama's term, and what does it portend for Republicans in 2016? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The Republican Party delivered a stunning blow to their Democratic opponents in Tuesday's midterm election, seizing control of the Senate, expanding its majority in the House of Representatives, and holding on to key governorships. Picking up at least 7 seats in the Senate, the election returned control of the upper chamber to Republican control for the first time since 2006. Republicans grabbed Democratic Senate seats in the states of North Carolina, Colorado, Iowa, West Virginia, Arkansas, Montana, and South Dakota. Races in Virginia, Louisiana, and Alaska remain too close to call. In the lower chamber, or House of Representatives, Republicans picked up at least 14 seats, giving the GOP, as the Republican Party is also known, one of its largest majorities since the 1940s. Analysts say these midterm results represent a repudiation of some of President Obama's policies and approach to governance. His popularity has plummeted, and members of his own party actively distance themselves from him in an attempt to stay in office. But that strategy clearly failed. Across the country, Republican messaging focused on President Obama, portraying him as a weak leader incapable of protecting the U.S. border, stimulating the economy, or projecting U.S. power abroad, never mind that Republicans often obstructed positive legislation in those very arenas. President Obama said his administration's core principles remained the same after Republicans won election victories, and acknowledged that he is not likely to agree with lawmakers on all of their proposed legislation. Nonetheless, both he and presumptive Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell expressed optimism that there are ways to work together on issues where there's broad agreement among the American people. Well, for more on the new political landscape and its implications for the remainder of President Obama's term and beyond are two veteran political analysts. John Fortier is a political scientist and director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center. He is also a regular columnist for the Politico newspaper. And Stuart Rothenberg, he's editor and publisher of the Rothenberg Political Report. That's a nonpartisan political newsletter covering U.S. congressional and gubernatorial campaigns, presidential politics, and political developments. He is also a regular columnist for Roll Call. That's Capitol Hill's premier newspaper. Both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Thank you, Carol.
Well, Stuart Rothenberg, great to have you back here at VOA. I'd like to turn to you first for your interpretation of the Republican victories and Democratic defeats. For example, what's the takeaway for our listeners sitting in either Lagos, Kigali, Kampala, Istanbul, for example? What are they to make of this?
Well, I think what they need to understand is the people who went and voted didn't like the president's policies or his direction for the country. Now, that does not mean the entire country. Remember, only a part of the population votes, particularly in these midterm elections, a smaller group of people come out to vote. And those who voted were older, more likely to be white, more affluent, more Republican, and more critical of the president's policies. That's what the exit poll showed. And they were pretty clear, I think, in their statement of dissatisfaction with the president's leadership. Now, earlier you suggest that maybe this was a repudiation of the president's policies, but I don't think this was so much about individual policies, although Republicans continued to be animated and upset about Obamacare, his health care program. This was more about a year of bad news. The American public is unhappy, depressed, pessimistic about the future. Some of the news has been political related, like Obamacare's launch, but others has nothing to do with it, whether it's Ebola or international crises. And the public is simply unhappy and wanted to express change. That's what the election was about. Midterm elections are usually referenda on the president, and that was exactly the case this time.
Turning to you, John Fortier, how do you see the midterm election results?
Well, I agree with Stu fundamentally that this is a midterm election where the president wasn't technically on the ballot, but the people had the chance to react against their president and did. One thing that I think people will point to is, well, our economy seems to be improving, especially when you talk to people around the world where things aren't going as well in Europe or parts of Asia. There's a slowdown, and they look at America and think, you're doing okay. Why is there this dissatisfaction? And I do think you looked in the exit polls and saw voters really not convinced that things are going as well as some of the numbers show, that this may be temporary, that they're still coming out of a long period since the financial crisis of joblessness, of worries about the future. And so they don't see that news as particularly good. And then I think, like Stu said, there are a number of other things that have just worn on the public about the president. A number of foreign policy areas not going so well. But the president has been, for this whole year, at about 40 or 42% of people saying they approve of the job he's doing. Every simple political science model you show would say that's not a good thing. President should lose seats, and this president has. And Republicans, while they won't certainly be in a place to really pass their own policies very much, they won't have the presidency, have a strong hand. They've increased their numbers in the House significantly, more than we thought, and have taken the Senate, and will be a boost for Republican optimism.
Turning back to you, Stu Rothenberg, for a quick follow-up on the election and the meaning of the election. As you said, these are midterm elections, and there are structural, historical factors that led to the so-called Democratic rout, the fact that, as you said, older, more male, white voters go to the polls in these midterm elections. They tend to vote Republican. These were congressional elections, and the president wasn't on the ballot, although he said his policies will be or were at any rate. Only approximately a third of the electorate went to the polls. I mean, this is astounding for our listeners overseas, whether in Europe or Africa or Asia, where turnout is much higher. But one more thing, what about if it's not necessarily a repudiation of President Obama and his policies, is it an endorsement of the Republicans? I mean, what does it say about the Republicans?
Oh, it's definitely not that. No, I mean, we have a long tradition in this country of the out party not having to propose particular legislative initiatives, but rather saying, look, this is your time. This is a referendum on the president, Mr. and Mrs. America. And this is an opportunity for you to vote yes or no on Barack Obama. And not only that, this is an opportunity for you to say whether you want more people in his party to empower him and to allow him to govern the same way he has in the final 2 years as he has in the previous 2 years, or do you want to check on him? Do you want us, the Republicans, to go to Washington to keep an eye on him and not let him do what he's doing? So I don't think any sane Republican would argue that this was about the Republican agenda. After the election, of course, Republicans will say this was an endorsement of their agenda. Mm-hmm. We see this all the time, whether it's Republicans or Democrats who win. But there is no mandate for the Republicans. The only mandate is to not let the president do what he was doing.
I agree with you, but with only one small amendment. I do think Republicans in the last few cycles have found themselves nominating some candidates that are really unelectable. And they've made a much better shot at it this time, electing some candidates who were broadly electable. Often some of them are, you know, quite policy-oriented. I don't think that's the message that the electorate was taking. That was primarily a negative on the president, but I think they are going to try to use that. There are certainly some aspects of what was set out on the campaign trail that they're going to try to pass in Congress and put in front of the president and show that they have an alternative agenda. If they're successful, that's somewhat helpful leading up to the presidential election. Of course, it also depends on a presidential nominee wanting to take up those particular policies. But generally, midterm elections are a reaction against the president. There were just a few glimmers of some candidates, I think, on the Republican side who were making the case that there should be an alternative to Obamacare or that there's a governing strategy. They'll try to use those tidbits to put things on the congressional agenda, which might remind people that they're not just the party of no. It's a hard thing to do, but they're trying.
Back to you, Stu Rothenberg. Just drill down real quickly into some of the specific races. How did the Republicans win in some very so-called Democratic states like Maryland, Illinois, Massachusetts?
There's a long history in this country of the minority party, the small party in a state, being able to win a governorship where they couldn't win a federal race, a Senate race, for example. Recently, over the past 10 years, we've had some Democratic governors in incredibly conservative and Republican states, and we've had Republican governors in some very traditionally Democratic states that would never send a Republican to Washington. So, you know, in the cases of Illinois and Maryland in particular, it was unpopular Democratic governors who raised taxes and or, in the case of Illinois, were surrounded by questions of leadership and corruption. And, you know, governors are evaluated more like a presidential race where the candidates are compared. Certainly in the Senate, the interesting thing was that a couple of states that went twice for Barack Obama, Colorado and Iowa, elected Republican senators. Most of the Republican gains were in states that went for Mitt Romney in 2012. But the Republican success in Colorado and Iowa is interesting. Frankly, John is absolutely right. The Republicans had very good candidates who ran very good races, but they also figured out a way to kind of soften their tone. This is not about really Republicans nominating and electing moderates. It's Republicans nominating and electing pragmatic conservatives who understand how to talk to swing voters and even to Democrats.
And let me just jump in on the governors. It was interesting because you definitely have today, many of our states are controlled by one party or the other, much more than they were in the past. You have red states where there's a Republican governor and Republican legislature, and similarly Democratic states. And there are different policies being passed out there. There are Republican states who are saying, let's move to have much lower income taxes, and Democratic states putting much more progressive, higher taxes and social programs. Some of that was at issue. And I think this year, a good Republican year, the Republican message prevailed. The places where they were able to win in the Massachusetts and the Marylands and the Illinois, there was an argument that taxes are going too high. And then we had some places where Democrats thought they were going to gain. In Kansas, I would say the argument against Tom Tillis in North Carolina was that the states had gone too far in cutting taxes and in cutting important education programs. And Republicans did quite well on all of those battles. So it was a good year for them. And I think some of those governors are going to come back much stronger. Very controversial races like Scott Walker in Wisconsin, where Democrats would have loved to have knocked him off. He's going to come back not only reelected, but with some bigger majorities in his legislature to do more.
And bigger ambitions, John, would you say, in the case of Scott Walker,
I think he does have an ambition in the White House, but it's going to be a big race.
Exactly. So implications for these governorships, Republicans, often these states are feeders for national elections. So that may be another implication.
We're going to see lots of people on both sides. Obviously, Hillary Clinton, the strongest on the Democratic side, but on the Republican side, more governors than you can count on a hand, and a large number of senators as well.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are John Fortier, political scientist and director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Stuart Rothenberg, editor and publisher of the Rothenberg Political Report. We're talking about the domestic and foreign policy implications of Republican gains in the U.S. Congress in the wake of U.S. midterm elections. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or keep up with us on Facebook, facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA. Here's a shout out to our loyal listener, Sharon Isitua from Delta State, Nigeria. Thanks for your feedback, Sharon. Well, back to you, Stuart Rothenberg. Let's go to the meaning of Republican control now of the Senate. They're already in the majority in the House, so they control the entire Congress. Talk about, what this means mechanically and in terms of power. They will now control committees, set an agenda.
Right.
Explain that.
Right. Well, you're right. They will have a majority leader, chair committees. They will have ratios on those committees that favor the Republican. The leadership will decide what legislation to schedule, what to bring up, what amendments to allow. The scheduling of the business of the Senate is important. I mean, they will decide what hearings to have and who testifies at the various hearings. So it will allow agenda setting. Beyond that, there are lots of questions, and maybe John has the answers. Yeah, the Republicans will now control the House and the Senate, and in theory, they should be able to work together to compose legislation that both chambers can pass. But again, we know that even the minority party in the United States Senate has a good deal of freedom to block legislation. And there are questions about how the Republican Senate and the Republican House will get along, even questions about how people inside the Republican Senate will get along with one another and inside the Republican House. So personally, I've been watching this from Washington for almost 35 years, and it continues to be a very intriguing situation now, as kind of leadership has to some extent been undercut and devalued by kind of the new technologies that we have and our new political system, really, in terms of fundraising and the like. So it's going to be challenging for the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and for the Speaker John Boehner.
Well, John Fortier, you've said on this program before that we already have divided government. Well, now it's really divided because now the Republicans are in control of the Senate. So back to you with respect to, you know, what this means for the next couple of years. Does the election outcome indicate that there will be more political gridlock potentially or perhaps less between the Congress and the White House?
Well, I do think that the fundamental situation is pretty similar. We don't have total control of government by one party. We have now the president and the Democratic side and both the houses of Congress on the Republican side. They have to agree to get big things done, and they don't really agree on the big issues, and it's going to be hard to do. And I think we'll see some of the same types of clashes that we've seen over the budget and other issues, and some big issues hard to get done. I'll pick up on what Stu said. Yes, Republicans will have the power of setting the agenda or setting the types of investigations that they can hold in the Senate. They'll also be tough on the president with his nominations. It might be hard for the president to get his judges and people in his administration through. And, you know, ultimately, what Republicans would like to do in some cases is to really pass some bills, pass them through the House, pass them through the Senate, and then put them on the president's desk for him to veto. But as Stu noted, you have all sorts of reasons why I think in many ways that won't happen as much as they would like. One additional factor I'll add is that we'll certainly see two or three senators on the Republican side running for president, and they are less likely to be team players. Ted Cruz and Rand Paul and Marco Rubio might not want to go along with the plans of Mitch McConnell. But let me say a few positive notes. I think second-term presidents always have a hard time doing legislation in a major way, but they've often find one or two issues that they can work with. And one issue is trade, where a president of the Democratic side is usually free trade oriented, but his congressional counterparts are more protectionist. With a Republican Senate and House and a Democratic president, that maybe is a better recipe for trade deals. I think maybe some corporate tax reform, possibly. And then, look, Republicans have said if the president needs help on a more robust strategy for ISIS, that they actually may be more willing to provide some of that help than some of his Democratic counterparts. So I think there'll be some smaller issues that they could agree on, but there's a window to do things, and we'll start to jump into the presidential race pretty quickly, and then things will get harder.
Exactly. Well, let me pick up on that. Back to you, Stuart Rothenberg. What about this argument that there may even be more common ground between the Republican Congress and the Democratic White House on issues such as tax reform, even infrastructure projects, job creation, and trade deals like this Pacific Partnership?
Well, on trade, I certainly agree with John. I think that's a possibility. Problem with everything else is the devil's always in the details. And so you take something like corporate tax rates. Everybody in this country, not everybody, most people seem to think that our corporate tax rates are too high and that it makes it harder to compete with the rest of the world. The problem is, if you're the White House and or Senate Democrats, are you simply going to bring that up and give that issue away without demanding something in return, like, oh, maybe increasing individual rates on the highest earners? Probably not. And once you do that, now we get more complicated. Now it's a question of now the Republicans have to agree to the second part of the equation. So I remain cautiously pessimistic. I guess that's the category I'm in. Look, you know, we talk about government in this country as if it can't do anything, as if everything is shut down. That's not the case. But it's laborious to pass things. So a farm bill, which once passed with a snap of a finger, took multiple years to get through. And we can get some transportation bills through, and some appropriations bills get passed, and continuing resolutions get passed. So things get done. But most Americans and most folks in the media, frankly, are interested in the real big deal. Fundamental tax reform, fundamental immigration reform. I still think that's very hard. But yeah, sure, there will be some narrow opportunities for the president to work with Congress. And I would hope that they would take them sooner than later, because John is absolutely right. The later you go in the year, the deeper you are into a presidential cycle, mm-hmm. and the more everybody's added the calculation of, oh, what does this mean for the 2016 elections?
Well, speaking of immigration reform, John Fortier, President Obama, in his post-election speech, said that he is likely to take executive action. He is impatient about promoting immigration reform. We have the Senate voted in favor, the House didn't, and he's threatening to take executive action. What do you think the likelihood of some kind of agreement will be between the White House and the Congress? And do you think President Obama will remain more patient to see if something can be done in a collaborative way as opposed to taking executive action again? Because he's got the Hispanic population very upset, one of his core constituencies and the core constituency of the Democrats. So he feels he needs to do something.
It's tough to imagine a big deal in the near future. I think we already saw that deal break down in the last Congress. It was hard to craft. And look, both sides are saying some conciliatory things and then also some things that say they want their priorities. And the president, I think, has been pretty clear that he is going to take some executive action. That's not going to please Republicans. They're going to be very unhappy about that. They're also going to come into the new Congress thinking they've, rightly so, gotten a pretty good boost from the election. They should get some of their priorities. So while I agree that there are these smaller issues they can work on, there are going to be times when the president and the Congress are putting their priorities there, and that doesn't really help the debate. So I think that the atmosphere is not great for a big deal. Perhaps we can move to some piecemeal and some smaller things that the Congress wants to in immigration, but I think it's going to be hard to do.
Carol, can I just add to that? I mean, I think one way to look at this is we're now 6 years into the Obama presidency.
Yeah.
Ought we expect a change of style from Barack Obama? And I don't see any reason to believe that. I think the president's quite confident in his goals. He has certain values. And in his final 2 years, if he can't get anything done legislatively, he can do things in terms of executive action and regulatory policy. The other thing is he can go to the bully pulpit and try to talk to the American people to change their directions and assumptions and priorities. But, you know, I don't think he's going to be in a particularly great mood to negotiate more with the Republicans. And nor do I think the Republicans are going to be that much more inclined to negotiate. They've just had a great election. Their attitude is probably going to be, wait a minute, the American public voted for us. We don't have a weaker hand here. So that is the problem.
Sounds like more gridlock than anything else. Well, John Fortier, what about the next couple of months, the so-called lame duck Congress before the new members of Congress take their seats in January? President Obama talked about a new authorization to fight against the so-called Islamic State, the ISIL, to replace this 2001 authorization for the use of military force against them. What other matters need to be taken care of?
Well, as always, we're going to face some budgetary problems. I think we're going to get just a temporary or continuing resolution. I think that the president has some key vacancies he's going to look to fill. While Democrats still have the hold of the Senate and might be able to force some of those through or cut some deals with Republicans. So from the Republican perspective, I think they are looking for more or less to push things to the next Congress when they have the better majorities and they're able to act more on their own terms. So I think we'll see us doing some of the basics, but not major policy.
Back to you, Stu Rothenberg. What about this so-called Obamacare, President Obama's signature domestic legislation that he's proud of, but which has obviously many flaws? Republicans seem bent on either repealing it or somehow defunding it. Where do you think that's going to go?
I just watched an interview with newly elected Senator Tom Tillis from North Carolina. He's a businessman. He looks like a businessman, sounds like a businessman. He's not a bomb thrower, but he's quite conservative. And he was asked about that. And he said he promised to vote to repeal Obamacare, and he will do that. And if they can't do that, then he will look to delay certain mandates and to delay or weaken the act. I don't think he's an aberration. I think that is the general rule among Republicans. They have voted how many times? 40 times? 50 times to defund it? What's 10 more votes? But again, can you really imagine the president allowing the Republicans to do anything to the centerpiece of his administration? I mean, Democrats have been talking about health care for 50, 60 years. So I think the Republicans will try, and then the president will not allow it. Probably Senate Democrats will stand in the way, too. And we'll be stuck where we are now. And maybe somebody else will have some new ideas that will be a compromise position, but it probably needs to come from some Democrats rather than the Republicans.
Well, back to you on that one quickly, John Fortier. The intent on many Republicans to try to repeal Obamacare, and notwithstanding the many perhaps flaws in it, the concept is a good one to cover many Americans who do not have health insurance. What about some kind of a compromise? Because just as Stu alluded to, Obama's going to be ready there with a veto pen if they'd attempt that. And then we'll have a lot of time passed and not much really accomplished in a positive way. That can't be good for Republicans in the long run or for their aspirations for the White House.
I'm not sure Republicans agree with you that it's a great concept, even. I think that certainly there are some aspects of the law, some provisions that they are in favor of, and they've argued that there has to be a replacement. But it's interesting to look at the public opinion on the law. It really hasn't changed at all. It's been sort of mildly unpopular for the last 5 years. Those who support President Obama like it. About 50% of the people don't like it. And it really isn't going anywhere, as Stu said. We've got divided government. The president can protect it. But you are going to see Republicans want those votes to say, look, we still think this is something that our base, and in fact, a decent portion of the American people really aren't that happy with. If we get control of one party or the other having government altogether in 2016, we might see some significant changes, but we're not going to see them now. But the fight is still there, and I don't think Republicans are shy about wanting to have these votes.
All right. Well, as we close, back to you, Stu Rothenberg. How do you think the new political landscape will complicate Obama's foreign policy objectives? Do you think he'll be pushed to be tougher, more or less across the board, whether, you know, with respect to Russia vis-a-vis Ukraine, on the fight against ISIL? Now we have an Iran deal coming up. This wasn't necessarily a big topic in the midterms, but many Democrats are not pleased with President Obama's leadership on the world stage.
Yeah. So I'd go back to my earlier question and say whether the president will change his style. You know, there's a significant difference between the president's style and values in terms of foreign policy, national security, international interests, and the Republicans. Republicans generally still favor using American might, military, economic rhetoric, more so than the president, who is more interested in a multilateral approach. That's on one level. On another level, Republicans like to bang the drums, but so far they're hesitant. You don't hear a lot of people other than John McCain and maybe Lindsey Graham talking about boots on the ground. But the Republicans certainly are more vocal in calling for the use of American power. I think the president is uncomfortable with that. I just think what we're seeing with the president is a reflection of his overall view of the world and power and politics, and I don't think that's going
to
change.
All right, and the last word to you, John Fortier. Now, do you think the political landscape with the likes of more hawkish senators like Robert Corker or John McCain, will there be a tendency to be pushing President Obama to be a little tougher?
Well, the irony of it is that second-term presidents really do often turn their attention to foreign policy, partly because they don't have Congress, partly because they're more experienced. But this president really was much more popular in foreign policy in his first term. Things were going well for him. I think now he has both some critics in his own party, worried that he's slipping back into the Middle East as he had promised to take troops out, and he has critics on the right as well. So it's a very narrow band he has to get support. Look, I think there will be support on things like ISIL. I think an Iran deal is potentially very divisive, where if the president has a deal he likes, you may find Republicans, you know, very much disliking it. And the push for more sanctions, which the president might feel might undermine his potential deals with Iran. So he has not been pushing foreign policy as much as foreign policy matters have been pushing him. Things he didn't want to have to deal with aren't going as well. There are a few areas where they'll find some common ground, but I think there's some potential minefields here for him.
I think that's very well said, and I'm afraid we'll have to talk about 2016 in the next round of our political discussions. That's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, John Fortier, Director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Stuart Rothenberg, Editor and Publisher of the Rothenberg Political Report. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Elzuber El Tayeb. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.
Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.